Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. First of all, Happy New Year. Haven't seen a lot of you since last session, so it's great to see everyone back in Jefferson City. A lot of people who are interested in education and making Missouri the best and brightest state that we possibly can, so really appreciate the good crowd that is here today. My name is David Pierce, and be serving as the chairman of this group today. Just briefly want to go over a little bit about the rebooting exercise, and this is the first of seven groups that are meeting for rebooting. This afternoon at 2 o'clock, there will be one on general government and Office of Administration workshop, just those two today. And then there's going to be several tomorrow. Retirement is going to be at 8:30 in the morning. Social programs at 11 in the morning. Tax structure is going to be at 2 on Wednesday. And then at 4 o'clock tomorrow, courts and judiciary, public safety. And then on Thursday morning, there will be one at 8:30. So it's going to be pretty busy the rest of the week. And then after we're done today, then our committee will meet and we'll kind of come up with a summary. Then we'll present it to the major group, which is rebooting state government presentation and recommendations, and that will be next Wednesday at 11 o'clock. And so we're not going to get everything done here today, but we're going to take a look at some of the emails that we've received, and then we will report back to the main group a week from tomorrow. So that's a little bit about the rebooting. Each committee has approximately four state senators that serve on it, and we are honored to have Senator Lamping, Senator Callahan, and Senator Cunningham who are joining me on this committee as well. Let me just give you a little bit of some of the ground rules for today. This isn't a traditional committee hearing, so we don't have to abide by the same rules as we do as a normal standing committee. Primarily, this committee is going to be going through the emails that we've received through the rebooting process. At times, if we have any questions, members of the committee might ask some folks that are in the audience for some clarification, for some input, and so we might be calling on you. And we are going to be recording this, putting this on the website, the audio on the website. So I would ask that if anyone is asked to speak, to come forward and tell us your name and speak in the microphone, so that way there will be a record for that. We've received, since last year's rebooting exercise, 74 separate emails. 74, that was as of last Thursday. And when the senators, when we left Jefferson City last Thursday, each one of us were given a notebook, and we had the opportunity to look at the emails. We were all given a notebook like this, and so we had the opportunity to look at those 75 emails. Staff put them in order or topics. One was just overall general topics. One was DESE, another foundation formula, higher education, and K-12. Since then, we've also been receiving emails. In fact, one came in 15 minutes ago. So there's a lot of interest, a lot of excitement, and there's probably another 25 or so, I would say, and there's more coming in. Obviously, we got to cut it off sometime, so we cut it off last Thursday as far as in the prepared presentations that you're going to see, but we will have other copies available later on. Patrick, could you raise your hand? Okay, this is Patrick, who also doubles as Mayor Pro Tem of California, Missouri. He loves it when I say that. So if you want copies of the other emails that have come in since last Thursday, Patrick would make that available for you. We're going to get started through the tabs in just a second. Senator Crowell also has requested to – there's no hurry. Okay, so anytime in the next hour or so, Senator Crowell will also be speaking to us. But before we get started, I'd like to open up for questions from my colleagues, and then we'll start with the first tab under general topics. So, Senator Callahan.
I don't really have questions or
no, any comments or anything?
Not really. I mean, I think the purpose, as the chairman indicated, was that we try to grapple with some of the issues. It's a broad subject matter, education. This is sort of an exercise so that probably in looking for saving money, we will probably better understand what the state is doing, hopefully identify some areas that could provide revenue, even in, within the context of education, that in those savings we could redirect some of the money toward the formula and toward funding per pupil education. So that's certainly my hope, and we started this last year. there are some issues that are unresolved from last year. They may never be resolved, but it's certainly a good beginning point.
Senator Lamping?
I don't
know. Okay. Senator Cunningham? Okay. As Senator Callahan mentioned, we went through this process last year. We did have, under the rebooting report that we gave, there were some suggested taxpayer savings identified last year, some $66.7 million. And I don't believe that we, as a body, acted upon those from last year, but we do have copies of what the final report was last year. Let's go ahead and our first tab that we received some emails, and if you want to go up there, fairly. There, let's go to general topics, and we'll just very, very briefly go through some of the emails here, and I've asked my colleagues to kind of summarize when we get to theirs as well. This very first one is from Steve Spellman, and his question was on the lottery, and as far as does all the money that comes into lottery actually go to education, or is it a somewhat a backdoor approach where we put it in, and then that money is taken out of general revenue? So, Ron, if you wanted to come up, or Mark, if you don't mind coming to the microphone, there's just a couple of things that I think might not be a bad idea for you to talk about as far as this is on the lottery, because there's going to be some other questions that deal with lottery. Did you understand what the question was? So,
of course, we all know that this is a 20
microphone on.
Green light's on.
Okay.
We all know that this is the 25th anniversary of the Missouri Lottery, started in 1986. When the lottery was initially passed, a lot of the advertisement centered around funding for education. However, in the initiative that was passed, it really did not speak to money going directly to education. Later, the General Assembly did direct that all lottery funds be dedicated to education. So in answer to the question, all lottery funds do go to education. But as we know, numerous budgets have been prepared since the time that law was passed, and I don't know that I could assure that those dollars were not used to backflow back to the budget. So the money is dedicated by statute to education. Probably over time, much of it was backflowed out to the general budget areas.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, Ron. I did notice that Senator Crowell came in, and Senator, if you wanted to come forward and make a presentation on your thoughts, that'd be great. I think members of the committee do have a copy of this, and we can make this available to anyone in the audience if they'd like a copy.
Thank you very much, members, and I appreciate this opportunity to be with you. I think delivered to your offices was a memo that I prepared on one aspect that I would encourage you to look at through a lens of people focused on education and education funding. I think that there are two ways in which we can help education when you look at the funding mechanisms. You can give education more money, or you can stretch the existing dollars that education has further by reducing expenses. The memo that I've shown you gives you a brief background of what our teacher pension system looks like, the unfunded liabilities that are associated with the teacher pension systems, how it's funded, and the direction of where it is headed to into the future. What I think is of importance and concern as it relates to education funding is the real projections that show that over time, more and more money is going to be taken from what we allocate for education to fund pension liabilities that are out there. This is no different than the debate that we had in our special session. One issue that is making this even more difficult, and it's not PSRS's fault or anyone else's fault, it's our own fault, for passing legislation that puts a 1% statutory cap on what the ARC, and that's the actuarially required contribution rate, can grow in any given year. And on page 2 of the memo, I spell this out, and what that is resulted in is $100 million every year for the last 7 years has not gone into the teacher pension system as would be required actuarially, but for that 1% cap. And we explain basically where we're at with that. when you start looking at pension systems, they're compounding. They're almost geometric in multiplying issues. That is to say, if you do something wrong in the first year and you build upon it in subsequent years, it's an exponential problem. It's not just, ooh, we made a mistake 7 years ago, because they build on each other over and over again on where we're at. So what I would encourage you to do, and would be happy to assist this committee in any way that it deems necessary, is to look at page 2 on some of the concerns and what we're doing. And I'll close with this. Right now, our teacher pension systems and PSRS has a matching contribution rate between the individual teacher and the district. Right now, that's at 28% of pay from what is going on with the actuarial requirements. If we were to follow without the statutory cap, what should actually be contributed to the pension fund this year, it should be 31% of payroll. That is going to result in $105 million shortfall to funding the pension system this year. And those projections, because of those shortfalls, will have continued increases in projected actuarially required contribution rates to grow all the way to 38% by 2020, meaning 19% of pay for teachers, 19% of pay for districts. Now, why is that important? Right now, school districts are contributing about $651 million a year to the teacher pension funds. If these projections hold true of what we're looking at, by the year 2020, school districts will be making $850 million in contributions to the pension funds that are there. That is a rather large increase over the next 10 years, and we're not really doing anything to address it other than tangentially saying, hey, there may be an issue that's out there. So I look forward to working with the committee. I look forward to working within the Senate this year and appreciate the opportunity to visit with you briefly on this matter.
Okay. Questions?
So in sum, then, you would propose eliminating the cap and then having whatever the ARC contribution ends up being. So if we were to enter into a period of 2 or 3 or 4 years of outsized investment returns, then theoretically the increase in contribution could be less than the cap.
Correct.
Right.
Theoretically, in what we look at, I think I would back up to a more fundamental issue. Either we're going to address this today and now, or we're just going to pass the buck to somebody else when the problem's even bigger.
Right.
You know, and really, that's the question that we face. Now, there's many individuals that are both on the federal and state level that look at these problems and say, oh my God, what can we do to put spackle over this in Bondo to just pass it on to the next generation?
Right.
Or there can be those individuals that say, you know what, we have an issue that's here, and our charge is to leave tomorrow better than we found it, and let's go do something about it. So I think that's the first fundamental question we've got to answer. Do we want to do anything about it or not? And then the second thing is, what damage are we doing in the long term for the short-term pleasure of having a 1% cap on the pension fund? Because we're just saddling future generations with a higher contribution rate.
And that's, too, with the assumption, I mean, you're assuming that if we do nothing that we have this big problem that's down the road, but you're also assuming that these pensions are going to grow at 7.5%, 8.5% over the course of these next 10 years. So you say without even the 6, we do need that type of investment performance just to be in the hole that we will be in. If we were to actually have the type of performance we've had the last 5 or 10 years, the hole would be even that much greater, wouldn't
Correct.
It?
Correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Very important topic.
Thank you all very much.
We will certainly consider it. Okay, let's go to the next email that came in from Fran, is that right? Fran Anderson. Mainly, Fran's comments were breakdown of the family is a huge problem facing our families. Need to focus more on reading, writing, and arithmetic. Next one deals, this is from Chris Beer, and supporting of MoreNet. Don't cut MoreNet funding. Next one is from Gary Clapp, St. Joe. Talk about the importance of investing in science, technology, math, and engineering. STME. So, next one from Angela Pierce, no relation. But she did spell it the right way. So Angela talked about if students are not keeping up, that perhaps we could go to Saturday classes, require parents and students to come in, give comp time to faculty members who work with these students, or give them extra pay like we would other folks like teachers, counselors, and things like that. And then finally under this tab is called kind of just some general areas. From Sibby Chilling, she mentioned about METS bringing priority. So we had two emails that came in that talked about the importance of METS or STEM, or however we choose to do that. Next tab is DESE, and have Senator Lamping go through that. Also like to welcome Senator Mayer here.
Okay, very good. Interestingly enough, the first email is one where I wasn't provided with a name, and I guess if you look at the context of the email or the text of the email, this is someone who suggests we completely eliminate National Parents as Teachers program, which is obviously something that we cut substantially last year. Now, these are all the emails that came in after the fact that were in support of Parents as Teachers, so I think there's a reason why this person didn't give us his full name. The next email comes in from Sean Calhoun, who wants us to focus on the ratio of admin to teachers, and he thinks that the higher teacher to admin ratio, the better it would be for the district. The next comes in from Patrick McAmini, and he wants to eliminate all busing and go back to neighborhood schools, and I guess that would be okay in St. Louis City and County, but we'd have some issues out around here in Jeff City.
If you don't mind interrupt, Ron, could you come up and... The as far as what some of the requirements are as far as administrators, teacher ratios and things like that, what is actually required versus what isn't?
Under the Missouri School Improvement Standards, MSIP, for years, in fact, prior to MSIP, the entire accreditation process was a resource standard only. And it was determined that you needed certain things in place for the opportunity to have quality education. With the Missouri School Improvement Program, it went beyond resource to process and then also student performance. Now it's more heavily weighted student performance. And in fact, due to actions that were taken by the General Assembly last year, the resource standards have been set aside because both transportation and the formula are not 100% funded. Having said that, there still is guidance that we look at, and I think there is merit to some definition of some components that are necessary for quality education. I do not have the MSIP standards with me, but there are desirable standards and there are minimum standards under the resource standards embodied in the present Missouri School Improvement Program. And, for instance, there are requirements that you have per number of students in elementary school, junior high, and high school, that you have a minimum number of administrators. For instance, at the secondary level, for a principal, that you needed one principal for 750 students. If you have more than 750 students, then you would need additional administrative services. That varies from district to district, depending upon the level of accountability that the administrators have toward the instructional process. So there are qualifiers or minimum standards and desirable standards that are set forth in the MSIP that require or required school districts, and that's suspended right now, to have a minimum number of administrative staff at the building level based upon the number of students. And then there were some requirements as far as the central district administrative staff. That is based upon the number of teachers that are in the district. If you, under the standards, if you had 100 teachers in the district, then it would call for some additional support to the central office administration because of the various functions, instructional, transportation, all of the things that are carried out to administer a school district. So I could get for you the exact standards that are in MSIP, but that's sort of a rough capture of what we require administratively.
And there are other suggestions in here about consolidating services with neighboring school districts and things like that.
Historically, school districts have done some of that. It's not been a common thing, but it has been done, and there's nothing that would prohibit two school districts today from sharing a superintendent or from sharing an administrator. And so that could be done today. We do have lots of school districts. In fact, I did some provided some information because the commissioner had indicated there might be interest about the school size enrollment. And the median point at 261 school districts out of the 522, 608 students, that's that school size. So 260 students or school districts have enrollments of less than 608 students. So there is capacity for that to be an option where feasible, where geographically that could work out. And I'd be glad to, I did bring some handouts I could leave with you.
Okay.
About the.
You know, we hear a lot about, in the local school district, they say DESE requires, and then DESE will say these are just standards, these are recommendations. And so sometimes there's a disconnect, and we just need to know that what is real, and then also what are some tools that we can give our local districts so they can make some of those determinations.
Well, in the past, probably the statement that DESE requires or the Missouri School Improvement Program did set standards, and each year school districts do report the number of teachers, whether they're qualified or not, the roles that they're performing, and then they would get back a report to the district indicating areas where you might be deficient because you didn't meet the minimum standard. So that is why that language is probably used, because if the Missouri School Improvement Program, which is our accreditation system, does monitor that and report back to you, then probably their statement was accurate. But as of this current year that we're in, for a two-year window, and it could be revisited, all of those resource standards are set aside. So the school district has its own discretion.
Great. Thank you.
Our next email is from John Baer, and he has some pretty big ideas. First, he'd like to kind of eliminate local school control, eliminate all local school district boards and superintendents, and have it all be centralized at some central location. He also would be in favor of capping retirement payouts of elected officials as well as educators, I think something along the line Jason, Senator Krause spoke of before. And then he also would like to have the Missouri religious groups take up a lot of the social services. I'm not sure why that's in our email here today. But our next email comes in from Rebecca Wright from Independence, Missouri. And I think essentially what she's hoping to, she's making the point that we need to best serve children through programs like First Step and for more fully funding the HOPE program to kind of get to children at an early age to help them in those very critical years, and that the outcome would actually be beneficial to the entire system, that by getting in front of these children early on, they would require less funding as they go through the system. And that's my last email.
Thank you. Senator Callahan?
Chairman, with your indulgence, I wanted to kind of combine the emails that we received, because some of the emails brought up some of the basic issues about the formula. Last year, this committee in process dealt with a couple of issues in the formula. There was a bill to try to make some of the corrections. Last year, this committee said that one of the suggested changes was to ensure that no district would receive more than double what it should receive through the formula. That was an estimated savings at the time of $16.7 million. Many of the emails, and I will summarize them, go into the formula and how it's set up. And I wanted to provide the committee with a basic framework of some of the issues that I'm sure some of you are familiar with that are public policy points within the formula. Not saying that they're wrong, I'm just saying that they are proverbial issues. The first would be, and not in order of importance, when the Senate passed the bill for the foundation formula in 2005, Senate Bill 287, provision was added in the House that school districts that hold harmless calculation for school districts with less than 350 students per pupil received a fixed dollar amount. One might argue that the practical result of this policy is that very small school districts can now lose students, in theory, down to one, and still be paid the same amount dollar amount as if they had 350 students. It also, in a broader sense, is an incentive not to consolidate, because if they're getting the same, if they have one, in theory, if they have one student and they're getting paid for 350, you have no incentive to consolidate. Also, that does nothing about school districts that may be losing students consistently. That's an issue. I know that there are two sides to every issue. There might be equally valid points. I'm sure the House had their reasons in 2005 for adding this. You know, these are all, I'm not making an argument. I'm just saying these are issues within the formula that the formula was our attempt to come with a broader, to replace an old formula. But, you know, when politicians get involved, there are changes, you know, and those changes are reflective of different interest groups. So that is one issue that the committee might look at. That's about roughly about $6 to $7 million a year, that issue. The other issue is one that we did deal with both the Senate, the House, and the governor, if you remember, which is the whole discussion of the more well-off hold harmless districts. Currently in the formula, it's provided that a hold harmless district can receive more than two times the funding, receive over two times. A practical idea might be that you cap it at two times. Right now it can vary well beyond over two times. The calculations that we've done and last year, as I recall, was about that would save about $31.9 million. If you were just to cap districts saying they're not going to get more than two times. The other issue that I wanted to deal with in the formula, as you're all aware, the currently school districts submit on their attendance for, under the current formula, they can go back 3 years. So it's not just this year, it's the preceding year and the second preceding year. That was probably an attempt to get more current data. You know, sometimes this is a moving target as far as attendance. But the other idea would be to say, just go back the preceding year. Do not allow that second preceding year to be counted in the daily attendance number. And that's about $30 million it would take. That would be $30 million less than it would take to fund the formula if you made that change. If you simply went back to the second attendance year. I know that I'm very familiar with this issue. As some of you are aware, I was involved in a boundary change election between independents and Kansas City. A source of controversy in some of the arguments in arbitration were that Kansas City went back and used this second preceding year, even though they had clearly lost students. And that number was no longer accurate. They were still paid for that second preceding year. In districts that are declining in daily attendance numbers, obviously this is helpful, not particularly for the formula as far as fair and equitable funding, but for the district because they can go back. If you in 1 year had 18,000 students and it's declined to 16,000, as you might imagine, districts submit the 18,000 number. So anyway, I do want to get to the emails. One last thing that was a provision of the formula. As you know, summer school was a discussion last year, that currently if we have a 25% premium on summer school attendance within the formula, a lot of this was sort of the discussion we had about and the argument about summer school. I happen to be a supporter of summer school, but districts actually have been reluctant, I think, because there's been sort of a chilling effect of that discussion of whether there will be summer school, and the unintended consequence has been as the formula kicks in, they now get a 25% premium on summer school attendance. So, again, in the summer school, that results in about $14 million less that we use to fund the formula. I wanted to provide a framework for the committee. I know we're not going to resolve everything today, but I just wanted to kind of say those are the issues. And now let me get to the emails. I'll briefly summarize those. This is about the formula. Many of them talk about the components that we brought up, which were the first email from Timothy Hogan in St. Louis. Talked about a more in revising the formula, the current disparities in funding, and talked generally about a method of equalization and equal distribution between the cost between urban and rural taxpayers, that we looked at some sort of property tax or certificate of worth to assess that. The next email was to ensuring that, and I referred to this kind of in the opening, that no school district should receive more than double what it normally does. As you know, there are some hold harmless districts that, under the current formula, do receive more than two times. And that email, I do not... Harris at Quantbon Education. Okay. Patrick Baker, eliminate the dollar value modifier to save money in education.
Patrick's our staff member.
Yes. I saw that. Yeah. I keep expecting this Donald T. Thing in here, but anyway. We filtered him out. Anyway, this next email is from Anonymous, and it talks about the importance of career ladder. The next email is from Karen Parker, and she comes from a small school district, and she talks about changes to the dollar value modifier. If you would eliminate this from Jan Perriman is also about the dollar value modifier, and Beth Van Baron from St. Louis, reconfigure how school districts receive funding, tax luxury item sales as well as property, don't cut state salaries, increase state sales tax on gasoline, cigarettes, and restaurant meals. And those were the emails. And again, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you wanted to deal with these under the formula, but the purpose of this committee is to find savings, and there are other issues if you want me to wait to bring those up that aren't formula related.
Well, I think that, and of course, the rest of the committee. Feel free to chime in. Obviously, we're looking at savings, but we're also looking at efficiencies and ways to make education stronger in our state. I think that our task today is to look at some ideas and then probably forward those on to the rest of our colleagues. So I think anything that you brought up, it certainly has merit, and we need to probably send that on to the rest of the senators. What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, you want me just to kind of say some of the issues we've dealt with? I didn't know if you were tired of me talking yet.
Well, that's a trick question.
Okay.
But does anybody have any questions of Senator Callahan? Or you brought up some good ideas. So
yeah, those are again
Yeah, those are all good suggestions.
And I'm done.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Callahan.
Just one comment, and I thank the senator for all his good ideas. I was taking great notes, and I'll have some questions for you later. Couple comments. Dollar value modifier, as probably many people know but some don't know, was in there to recognize the cost of living differences around the state. And it's my guess that those emails came from certain areas of the state, not others, which is obviously understandable. The second thing is with regard to the comments on the raises at DESE, I think what we need to look at to make sure that we are really comparing apples to apples is that were some people not rehired? Did some people retire, which I think they did? And overall, is the salary the same, more or less, than it was previous to those raises? My understanding is that those were not raises. They were moving people to a different responsibility and position, and that those reflect the previous people's salary at that same position. That's my understanding. I just want to make sure that we don't imply something that's not accurate. Okay.
Okay. We wanted to welcome Senator Brown as well here today. And the next tab deals, I think, mostly with higher education. And Senator Cunningham, if you want to walk us through those.
That's fine. What I did was consolidate all of the emails, and I'll tell you how many responded to the same ideas, because I had a lot of them. Some people said eliminate the Department of Higher Ed. One person said that, eliminate the Department of Higher Ed. There were a couple of people that talked about consolidating DESE and Higher Ed. Another comment was that the university has too many holidays, many more than the state holidays that we already recognize are quite generous. They even mentioned like homecoming was a holiday at one of the universities, so we need to cut down on holidays. A suggestion was that professors take a 10% pay cut, that we sell MOHELA since the federal loan regs take over sales of student loans. Five people commented on closing some colleges, that we have too many, and duplication of much of the curriculum. There were five people who also talked about the A-plus scholarships. They were on both sides of this issue with regard to equating them to public and private, and they were on the other side as far as the old way that we used to do it, reflecting the tuition of the college and then having A-plus, but we dealt with that last year. So, right, didn't we finalize that last year? So these comments are really sort of, I guess, either not recognizing we dealt with it or saying we revisit it. But there were a number of comments on that. They think that I got a comment to end college tuition reimbursement for state employees, end professor emeritus positions, and separate research from their education functions, making sure that if they are a state employee at a university, that any research that comes out gets shared with the other universities so that we are not duplicating research efforts, and that the outcomes of those as far as privatizing it is owned by the universities, which I think is already the case anyway. This was an interesting one, because the last one I'm going to mention, because I have found this to be true too. They mentioned that local schools, colleges, even local governments do not always go out for bids on insurance, and that would save a considerable amount of money if actually they followed the statute, which requires bids. It's something that I had looked into when I was in the House, and that is accurate. That's the end of all of them consolidated.
Thank you very much, Senator Cunningham. Paul, if you wouldn't mind coming forward, we might ask a few questions. As Senator Cunningham mentioned, there were several comments on consolidation of non-duplication of effort and program. And you might briefly talk about the governor's academic review process and where we are in that. And then there, if there's any other questions, go ahead.
Okay. The governor had Paul Wagner, Deputy Commissioner of Higher Education. Over the summer, the governor convened a higher education summit in August. And one of the initiatives that he charged us with carrying out is a review of all low enrollment academic programs at the public colleges and universities. So there was an existing threshold in Missouri in our board's public policy about how many graduates a particular academic program has had over the past few years. If it was below a certain threshold, that we would We would review that program and see if there was a compelling reason to keep it, if it could be consolidated, combined, or eliminated that our board could recommend. So we've undertaken that process. Where it is right now is we've identified all of those programs, all the public institutions. We've shared that list of programs with all the schools and have gotten their responses back as far as how they would propose those programs be dealt with. There are many of them that where we've gone had to go back to the schools to ask for further documentation of their rationale or further information as far as details about how they might consolidate or how they might combine with another program. We owe a final report to the governor on that in early February. Our board will approve that report, hopefully, at its February meeting, and then we'll pass it on to the governor. So that's been a very robust process. I've been pleasantly surprised by the cooperative and energetic participation of the institutions. I think part of that is because I think these kinds of reviews are undertaken on a regular basis by our institutions, but having this third party kind of pushing down, saying you all need to do this, it kind of gets the whole campus in the same mode of thinking, and I think that kind of cooperative spirit kind of permeated some of the campuses, and it made a much more productive process. I mean, several schools went ahead and identified more programs than even we had looked at that said they wanted to consider possibly eliminating them. So we'll have that full report in early February, and we'll pass it on to the governor and to the General Assembly as well at that point.
Mr. Cunningham?
Has it been considered to do some of those programs virtually? In other words, do internet courses, maybe share from one college to another one, rather than just totally closing them down? Because even though, I mean, one of the advantages of virtual classes is that you can have very few students and still deliver it very inexpensively.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the, in some respects, that's what our role is as a coordinating agency. Is that, you know, for example, there might be French has come up somewhat regularly across many institutions as being a program that doesn't produce many graduates. Doesn't mean that it's not an important program. There's lots of important places in the world that have French-rooted languages. It's important if we're going to teach our kids to be citizens of the world in a global-focused, global economy. We need, you know, people who understand French. So part of our role, I think, would be we can't have everyone eliminate French if it's a low-producing program. And certainly that's an option when I talk about we're going to consolidate programs or we're going to find some other method of delivering them, is that, you know, just like you're saying, there might be, you know, a professor at University of Missouri, for example, who's going to operate French, and students at other institutions can sign up online and take that class there. I also want to mention at the same time one of the other initiatives to come out of the governor's summit from this summer was a course redesign concept that's been pioneered by some of the national leaders in education that we're going to implement at least on a pilot level in Missouri. Whereas basically you take many of your largest common classes, so like for example your introductory English comp or college algebra or something like that, and you would transform that from a lecture to a student format into more of an on-site yet online format where students will learn at their own pace, and the professor is there simply to assist the students who are having difficulty as opposed to trying to manage all the students at once. And that really is a way to leverage technology to teach more students with fewer resources. So certainly movement into the online atmosphere, students enrolling either in a blended fashion, some on campus, some online, or 100% online. It's really growing at all types of higher education institutions in Missouri.
Are you all using any virtual classes for your remedial? Because I know remedial is going up at colleges, and if we can save some money there, particularly for parents who are kind of paying double, they've already been in high school and had preparation, and now they're paying for those courses again. Do we do virtual in any of those?
I'm not sure how much of our remedial developmental coursework is done in a virtual fashion, but I can
let us know. Okay,
on that for
thanks.
You.
In this process of reviewing the programs of study that you may eliminate, will your committee come up with an estimate of the impact it'll have on the student population? Will you suggest to all, you know, the decline in enrollment that may occur as a result of eliminating certain programs?
Well, you know, there's certainly, you know, it has been a numbers exercise in the sense that we know how many students have graduated in particular years, or the past 3 years for each of these programs. Okay, first of all, our board can't recommend that a program, we can recommend that a program be closed. We can't
implement
that. That's up to the local governing board to do that. Now, I think our hope would be that there would not be any loss of enrollment, because you're going to teach out whatever students might be in that pipeline. So, again, for example, if the University of Missouri decided it was no longer going to offer a major in French, they would maintain the program. For example, if there are sophomore French majors,
right,
they would teach through the program.
You're not just looking for short term; you're looking for intermediate and long term savings.
Right.
So, to the extent that we eliminate however many number of programs, if we lose a corresponding like amount of students to other institutions, then I think to be complete in your cost savings analysis, it'd be important that we may have a projection of lost enrollment. So if we were to save X millions of dollars by eliminating programs on one hand, on the other hand, we may lose X millions of dollars due to not having those programs of study to offer and having students seek them outside of our system.
Sure. I mean, the only thing I would interject there is that this, we were not charged to make this about saving money. We were charged to make this about focusing institutional missions and as Senator Cunningham was talking about, making the whole enterprise run more efficiently. Mm-hmm. We were not asked find out how much we're going to save, find out how much is being spent. So
I understand. So maybe it's something for the reboot committee then.
But, maybe that's the next step. You know, maybe we present this report to the governor,
right?
And institutions are deciding how they're going to implement, yeah, you know, whatever findings there are. What, you know, maybe at that point we can say let's start documenting the financial impact of this, and that would certainly be a component is if we've lost.
I appreciate your charge, but I would suggest that the reason that you've been asked to do what you're doing is centers around cost savings.
Could be, yeah.
Desi talked about the standards as far as administrators and things like that. We don't really have that in higher education. Do you see something like that being a byproduct of this academic review process?
Are you talking about like the credentials, teaching credentials?
No, more as far as ratios, as far as no more than based on.
I think that's kind of, I mean, in this environment, it's kind of going the opposite direction. I mean, you know, when we talk about doing online classes, we're talking about doing the course redesign where I mentioned that we're, you know, teaching students more at their own pace with a professor that's more like a monitor as opposed to a lecturer. You're talking there about moving towards a higher student teacher ratio, if that's what you're getting at. You know, I think that's what, in higher education, when we think about how are we going to leverage technology, you know, one, we're interested in improving student learning, and secondly, when we talk about efficiency, we're talking about teaching more students with fewer personnel, because that's where you save money at a college or university, is on personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people see technology as the key to the efficiency of teaching larger classes with fewer staff while not negatively impacting and, in some cases, improving student learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Senator Cunningham mentioned one of the emails dealt with no bids for health insurance. Or work comp. Can you talk about how the universities do that or don't do that, how some are autonomous and how they...
I'm not familiar with how institutions do workers' comp insurance. I will have to investigate that. And get back.
And I think health insurance, didn't they mention that as well?
Well, the public institutions are, with the exception of the University of Missouri, they have their own self-funded institute. All the other, the public institutions are in Mosiers, like state employees. So, I mean, okay. Okay. All right.
If you could find out more information on that.
Workers' comp. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be good to get that to us. Any other questions of Paul while he's here? Okay, don't go away.
Won't go far.
All right, it won't go far. Okay. The final tab deals mainly with K through 12, so I'm going to summarize these very quickly. This one brought up several points. One, merit-based teacher pay is a must. Person that had some concerns about expanding pre-kindergarten programs, somewhat leery of that. And also favored studying a school voucher program. Felt that was a step in the right direction. Okay, the next one. Had two folks talk about getting rid of the Parents as Teachers program, and Senator Lamping also mentioned this in some of his tabs, too. The national headquarters, obviously, is in the St. Louis area and felt that that should be done. I will say there's a lot more people who support Parents as Teachers as opposed to those that want to eliminate it. The one from Fran... just a couple of things that Fran had mentioned. One was remedial programs in colleges and universities don't have that, and I think going along with that, that students that come into college shouldn't need remediation when they get there. I think that was kind of the thrust of what she was saying. And raising mandatory attendance in high school to 18. Doesn't like alternative schools. The next one from Kevin Hess dealt with consolidation of administrators. Another one from Stratford, Missouri, talks about financial literacy, the importance of having parents and students being financially literate. Let's see. The one from... there was one that talks about consolidation of transportation, and that was, let's go on to the next one there, dealt with, you know, you might have somebody that lives on the road and three different school buses from three different districts come by, so consolidation of transportation services. There was one from... last name of Loudon, and that dealt with using our school buses for other things besides just transporting children. Perhaps oats and things like that can work together to save on transportation costs. There's three that dealt with keeping parents as teachers, reducing DESE. Dan mentioned no computers for students until they get into high school. They don't need them until they get there. Yeah. There's some interesting emails that we received, needless to say. Barbara brought up the 4-day work week. Ron, can you talk about, I know that we brought this up in the legislature the last few years. I think it was in one of the final versions of the bill. We ended up passing that, didn't we, to give that. Why don't you tell, local control on that. Can you mention that?
Paul did what I had been failing to do. Benefit. I am Ron Lankford, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, on board since August 1st of this year. And yes, the General Assembly does make provision for a 4-day school week at the discretion of the local school district, and they determine, based upon the criteria set forth in the law, as to whether or not they're going to opt for that. You can't get into it and start missing snow days and say, oh, we're going to mix and match. You have to have a declaration of your intention to do that. For many school districts, there would be potential for savings. If you are a sparsely populated, large geographic area, you might save quite a bit. For other school districts that might be more densely populated, it has to be a local decision, and I think that's why you've seen so few people opt for that. One unanticipated you would save costs for the buses operation and your utilities. However, your bus costs just as much, your building costs just as much. About everything costs just as much except the utility downtime. The factor that weighs into the mind, has weighed into the mind of lots of school districts, in my opinion, has been we tend to, as a society, in our normal economy, think in terms of a five-day work week. And so if you have a population area that's not extremely spread out, it's concentrated, then you displace a lot of burden back on the part of the parents. So on that fifth day, what do you do? And then another thing that I've just done personally is, as I philosophically wrestle with this, why I do see justification in some areas. If you look at the numbers of hours that our school buildings are used over the course of a year, and then you opt off another day, you would be shocked to find out the percentage, the high percentage of time that our facility is not used. If you are, this idea generated more in the western states where you have large areas. I happen to know superintendents that have school districts that one superintendent in South Dakota, for him to visit his three attendance center, takes him 3 days, leaves on Monday morning, gets back on Wednesday night. If you have students who have a work environment, there might be benefit in that area. For many school districts, though, there probably is no cost savings. I ran a calculation one time and found that a school district could save 4% of its fuel, or its fuel cost for buses was 4% of its budget, or excuse me, 0.4%. So it really didn't make a lot of sense to.
Have any school districts gone to that?
To my knowledge, in the state of Missouri, I'm not aware, but. Lathrum? Okay.
What was the school?
Lathrum.
Lathrum.
But it's a small, yeah, but it's not a big school district.
Okay. One school district has.
I do think it's a local option that is there, but few have opted to use it for a variety of reasons.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Don't go away. There have been a lot of suggestions on consolidation, and the ones that sent them in were favoring that. Can you tell us currently what state statute is that allows the ability currently to do that?
Well, the law does set forth the protocol for reorganization of school districts. And as a teenager growing up, I saw that happen in my rural area over the years. But basically, it's initiated at the discretion of the local school districts. So they begin discussion about reorganization. And Mark may have a little bit more information. If you would let Mark step up here.
Introduce yourself.
Members of the committee, my name is Mark Van Zandt. I'm general counsel for the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. To address your question, there are really four ways in which schools can be reorganized. Some are done fairly often. We have one maybe every other year. Some are rarely done, and you can kind of see based upon the structure. Probably the simplest is a change in boundary line, which the senator pointed out Kansas City and Independence went through, I believe, 2 years ago. And that's done, it's initiated by a petition, and it's voted by the voters on both sides for both districts. If they both adopt the change in boundary line, it goes through. If they both reject the boundary line, it doesn't go through. If one side adopts, the other side rejects, then it goes to a board of arbitration appointed by the state board, and the board makes the decision about the boundary line change. The next is annexation. That's where an entire district becomes a part of generally a larger district, and that, again, can be done by petition of the voters, or it can be put on the ballot by the local board of education. It's the same process. If the voters approve the annexation, then the issue goes to the receiving Board of Education, and that board decides whether or not it's in the best interest to accept this new area. And then if they approve, then the district, the initiating district, becomes a part of the receiving district. There's a process called a reorganization that, as Dr. Langford pointed out, was done quite a bit in the late 50s, early 60s, but you don't see as much anymore, where a county commission can go through and completely reorganize, in most cases, smaller rural districts, and in many cases, K-8 districts, and reorganize them into larger districts. If you see the titles of some schools, R8, R7, that's from those reorganization plans, and those plans come from the county commission to the State Board of Education, and the State Board of Education will approve them. But as I said, it's been a number of decades since that's been used. And the next is consolidation, and again, it can be done by petition, and that's where two districts decide to become one, as compared to an annexation where one becomes the part of another. These are two districts that have said, we want to become a single district, and the voters can of each district can vote to approve that. So those are the statutory ways in which districts can determine their own fate in terms of if they want to recombine or change their boundaries. The last option is not really a voter-initiated, but sometimes goes along with that. If a district becomes unaccredited and they fail to re-achieve accreditation by a statutory timeline, or if they become financially insolvent, they lapse as a district, and then it becomes the responsibility of the State Board of Education to reorganize those districts. And they have a number of options, including operating it temporarily with a special administrative board, realigning it with another district. If it's a large enough district, they can break it up and operate it as smaller districts. But that only occurs in the cases of loss of accreditation or financial stress.
Okay. Questions? Senator Lamping.
Well, I just want to reconfirm then. So as much as we've heard today from people that they'd like us to consider consolidation of school districts, it sounds like something that really has to be initiated at the local level. So we'd have to legislate a mechanism then, if we were to create a new way to initiate consolidation. Yes. Okay.
Senator Cunningham.
Do you have any suggestions on incentives to encourage districts to consolidate? Either one of you?
Okay. Under the reorganization plan that Mark spoke about, that lots of reorganization took place, there was an incentive. School districts were given $50,000. So each school district, if it went into another school district, there was a $50,000 state fund that went with that school district. The intent was that would help put in place the cost of taking that district in, and I can show you some elementary schools that were built in the 60s, back when building was much cheaper, that a lot of those $50,000 were used for that. The incentive that the state might have, I will be honest, people want to maintain their school districts, and I'm not sure there is an incentive that would cause them to want to reorganize, because those opportunities have been there for well over four decades, actually since the Constitution 1945 and reorganization started in 1948. So ample time has been given. I'm not sure what the incentive would be, quite honestly.
Well, if you all can come up with putting your heads together and come up with some good ideas, that might be helpful. I went to an education conference this year, and they told us the sweet spot as far as the number of students in a school district that is the most efficient is 7,000. Right around that number. If you get more than that, the inefficiencies come in. If you have less than that, obviously they're there. I don't know, and you probably don't know off the top of your head, how many of our 500-plus districts are right in that 7,000 range.
I actually have a handout that I can leave with you.
Oh, that answers that question? Okay, thank you.
Senator Callahan.
I could give you that information if the others would want to hear it, but from the 4,000 to 6,000 school district, that size right now is 26 school districts, 4,000 to 6,000. 6,000 to 10,000, there are 8, there are 17 that are 10,000 above, 3 that are above 20,000. Then I have the lesser number, too.
Thank you. Senator Callahan.
Yeah, Mr. Van Zandt pointed out the legal mechanism for changing and consolidation. I wanted to kind of remind everybody, the formula itself is an incentive not to consolidate.
Right.
Because if I have one student and I'm paid for 350, the formula itself is a disincentive to consolidation, the way we currently have it. When the foundation formula went and was changed, in 2005, one of the changes was that you get paid not on a per pupil basis, but a flat amount. So I'd like to remind Desi, while that was the work of a legislature, and whether you agreed or disagreed, there is a huge disincentive to consolidation if you continue to pay people for 350 students when there might only be five.
And
now,
what's
broader
that number?
Public policy discussion. And by the way, there's 171 school districts with 350 or less students.
Number.
Right, and then in addition to the funding in aggregate, as you have mentioned, we have the additional $15 million small schools grant. So there are two factors that come into play to that body of schools.
And then this is a broader discussion, but, as far as there was reference to the boundary change, and I would just say that I'm not necessarily blaming the person who's been here since August, but the way Desi handled that, I think that was kind of a disincentive as well to a solution to urban education. But I can deal with that more directly in private.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Just going on some other suggestions that we had. There's a couple people, that talked about cutting summer school. There was a one, I don't have a name on here, it's on page 37, that talked about fund balances. And Ron, I might have you stay up here. The concept of that districts have our high fund balance reserves and the state is somewhat subsidizing that, and that there should be a cap put on that, or if they exceed that, then perhaps they get less funding.
At the present time, the state of Missouri does not regulate the fund balances that you can have as a local school district. Probably the fund balances that some school districts have accrued over time have been a big help to get them through some troubled times that we have right now. And I do think that is a discussion that, like all discussions, you can weigh in on either side. I recall the state of Kansas a few years ago had no limit on their discretionary fund balances. About 25 years ago, they changed that. And if you would watch what happened in the state of Kansas during this economic environment, if they were making an immediate cut, then the school district felt the impact of the immediate cut within that school year. And so sometimes adjustments were having to be made. Many school districts in Missouri were able to avoid that. The basic question maybe ought to be asked is, did the school district accrue the fund balance by not doing what it should have been doing, which was paying teachers, providing programs for students, all of the things that brought about a well-rounded education? If you recall, under the previous formula, there were lots of school districts who were big beneficiaries of additional funding, and money came in at a very rapid rate. There were some who believe that you should plan for the infusion of those resources so that you're making wise expenditures, not expending those just simply because you have them. And I think in my opinion, that we need to be cautious by simply saying the fund balance is too big. I think that we have to go back and say, what did that school district, how did they accrue the fund balance? And, again, that gets very difficult. But if they did it by not doing what they should have done, which was provide programs to students, adequately compensate the staff who's educating or dealing with our children every day, and not maintaining their facilities, I think we have a real problem.
Well, on average, what would be the reserves around the state?
I have not looked at that, Senator Pierce, to know, but at one time it was, 23%, Mike? Something like that?
It's in the ballpark.
Probably a little less than that because some school districts have had to spend down in the last couple of years.
You mean 23% of annual operating budgets?
Current expenditures, yes.
I'd love to see those numbers. I'd love to see the total dollar amount and the rate of growth.
We can get that.
If you can get that to us, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, there was a couple more that we received. Page 36 talked about cutting summer school. They were for cutting that. and page 39 talked about cutting transportation. As I did mention, since Thursday, we've received about another 21. So it looks like we've had about 95 different comments so far. I would say probably half of those dealt with parents as teachers, and obviously they were all in support of parents as teachers, and the verbiage was very similar in most of those. Talked about early childhood programs as well, and there were four or five that also dealt with consolidation, the importance of looking at consolidating school districts. A couple of others that were interesting. One, get rid of multiple choice on MAP. And I think that those are some of the highlights of that. Again, the ones that that came in since last Thursday, if somebody does want a copy, they can get that from Patrick. That about wraps up looking at the emails. And we're
going to write.
Okay.
I didn't know if you were going to see.
That's where we're headed. So, so I certainly want to hear the inputs and overall thoughts from the folks on the committee. Senator Cunningham.
Why don't I just start, because I've been kind of looking at where we are, and I think it's important for us to know where we are when we focus on where we're going to go. Right now, only half of our students, and it may be less than that, but about half of our students or less, are proficient in our core subjects. So 50% of our kids are not doing it according to the standards that we in Missouri and the teachers in Missouri have set. We know that nearly 40% of our students that graduate from our high schools are having to take remedial courses in college. This is something that's been coming out and highlighted recently quite a bit. There was a story in the Post-Dispatch. And so I think we know that we have got a serious deficiency in preparing our students for college and for work. So we need to look at that. Missouri has 899,000 students, public school students in the state of Missouri. Of those, 103,151 attend a school district that is not fully accredited. To me, that is a roaring crisis. 103,151 attend a school district that is not fully accredited. Obviously, I'm from the St. Louis area, and I'm particularly interested in the fact that 84,000 of those are in the St. Louis area, the economic engine of the state. We have 24 districts that are either unaccredited, well, that are not fully accredited or on a watch list. A watch list, as we know, means ones that are in trouble academically or financially. So we've got 24 districts that are really struggling. Two are totally unaccredited, St. Louis Riverview Gardens, and Wellston has already been consolidated into Normandy. Now, if we look at, you know, what are reasons for that? It's not money, because since 1996, we've increased funding 110%, while enrollment only went up 2%. So I guess I just put that out there as those are the statistics, objective statistics of where we are. So then what do we do as a result of that? I know in your 2020 committee, we came up with the conversation of, you know, do we do more of what we've been doing? If we do, how long will it take to improve achievement? Do we need to do something differently? And I think one of the members of that committee, Senator Robin Wright Jones, asked Mr. Van Zandt for a graph on, you know, where we've been. Is the achievement the same? What have we changed that has achieved it? We've obviously put in a lot of money. How did that determine the graph? Is it still flat? It seems to be. So what came up in that committee was, we really need to do something different. We need some new ideas, and so I would throw some of these out as a result of that. We obviously have a new situation with the Missouri Supreme Court decision on Turner versus Clayton School District that interpreted statute that was obviously already in place to allow some students in these districts that are struggling or unaccredited, well, that are unaccredited, to be able to get to an accredited school. So that's something I think that we need to address. How do we immediately get these 103,000 children to a good school, or at least those in an unaccredited district? People have talked about trying to use tenure reform and performance pay, not only to give tools to school districts so that they have the ability and the tools to put the best teachers in the schoolroom, because we know that the quality of the teacher is extremely important to the outcome of achievement. So I think if we look at tenure reform and also being able to pay teachers who really are performing highly as gauged by their student achievement, that we need to be able to pay them more. Now, I realize we don't have any money. I realize that one of the ideas that came through was the career ladder funding. Originally, career ladder was initiated to reward high-performing teachers. So it was a performance-based pool of money. But I do believe that many of our businesses are very interested in a skilled workforce. In fact, Senator Lamping and I met, and others met with some of the high-level businesses, their leaders in St. Louis a few weeks ago, and they're very engaged in trying to find some answers to get a skilled workforce. And I do believe that they would be interested if we gave them a fund they could contribute to that could go towards performance pay. I do think we'd get private donations to that, because many of these companies are already donating to schools, but this would focus it on something that I think could not only reward good teachers, encourage them to stay in the classroom, but affect our achievement. Social promotion is another one that has been mentioned that we address. Virtual schools, it is the delivery system of the future, and I know funding has been cut for that, but to move away from a delivery system of the future that is highly effective, very rigorous, and very inexpensive to deliver is going backwards. So I think we need to look at virtual delivery systems for our schools. Right now, the city of St. Louis public schools are spending, I think, over $16,000 per student to deliver virtual education at any time and any place that the student wants to take it is roughly $5,500. That can be done in a hybrid model like they do in Chicago, with sometimes in a bricks and mortar classroom, sometimes at home. It's very flexible. So we may need to look at that. I think also virtual education could be used for our summer schools. We've been talking about the cost of summer schools. Do we keep them? Do we let them go? Do we use them only for the core subjects? But I think our summer schools can also be delivered quite inexpensively in a virtual manner. Let's see, charters. I think if we look at the tools that we need to give our school districts, I think chartering would be one that we need to look at, because I don't think many of our rural districts realize the advantages of being able to use the laws under charters. For instance, if you chartered your whole district, that would mean that you would not have to deal with tenure. You could hire the teachers that you know are performing and more easily not renew contracts of people that are not performing. Right now, it's a maze and a documentation process that I understand somebody reported takes 2 years. At any rate, I think that chartering can allow many of our districts who don't have that opportunity now some tools that may advantage them and help them be able to perform and give higher achievement. We may want to look at, I've heard from a number of parents, particularly in rural areas, and we've talked about the boundaries of school districts, and sometimes that can be inhibiting. For instance, the district lines were drawn many, many years ago, but sometimes things have changed. For instance, if you look at Lake of the Ozarks, they built a lake. That is a huge division between school districts that complicates those lines. Some parents have found they are much closer, either time-wise or mileage-wise, to a school in a district that they are not assigned to. And so I think we need to probably look at some flexibility to some parents who could become more involved in their child's class because they could get to a school faster if we allowed them some flexibility along that line. Hardship transportation, you might call it. That's all.
Well, I appreciate the spirit of today's gathering. I very much appreciate Senator Cunningham's comments, and I think those are some big issues that we'll certainly take up during the course of this session. And very much appreciate Senator Callahan kind of rolling up his sleeves and getting into the details and the nuts and bolts. And I think part of what we're here today to do is to find the $100,000 million solutions that are out there and bundle them together. I would just add to what we heard today and from both Senator Callahan and all, everyone on this committee, I think it's easy to underestimate the cost of less than substandard outcomes. I think what's headline news today, and I think in our state and all states, is this number, this 24-25% of all incoming freshmen having to take remedial courses and having to provide for that, and the cost that, to the extent that we subsidize higher education in the state, we're doing it yet again to transpose skills that should otherwise have been learned in high school. I would recommend there's a great book that I just finished. It's called The 5-Year Party. And it's a very simple read, a simple, quick weekend. It talks about what's going on in higher ed, has been going on in higher ed these last 20 years or so. And now you've got the point now where the average student takes 6 years to graduate. And if you contemplate the fact that we're subsidizing education in some way, shape, or form, if we're trying to come up with an educated workforce, it's taking us 6 years of subsidies to get that person instead of 4 or 3 years, where if they were ready to go, I think it would have an impact. So I think it's easy to underestimate how much it costs to have kids actually graduate, but graduate lacking the things that they really need.
Senator Callahan?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what your, as always, I defer entirely to your leadership, but I don't know what your, I guess I my recommendation for some of the things we've talked is on just an entirely budgetary mechanical way is whatever I brought up, I'm not necessarily taking a position on. There's probably other issues maybe I missed. A subjective, what are the proverbial issues that come up with the formula? We have a finite amount of money to go to the formula. It's not going to be fully funded. It's going to be a struggle to fully fund it. Whatever we fall down at after the governor's recommendation, it then comes to us. I would suggest, with your indulgence, that maybe we bring up some of these formula issues. We have a new Senate. We have a new House. Maybe there are good reasons to have all these, but I don't know. When you give your report and we all give our report, I think it would be good for the body to say, okay, this might make sense to have it in the formula, but it costs $31 million a year. And that's $31 million less. And so, by the way, the committee last year did that, and I think you served on it, did you not? And one issue was just the basic component of the formula, that no school district should receive double. That was one of your suggestions last year, what it should receive through the formula. Okay? Let's have that issue. I would certainly suggest, I'm not sure everybody in the body understands that some districts get money for 350 students and they don't necessarily have 350 students. Maybe there's a good reason to have that. I understand that there's rural districts are different than suburban and urban districts. But let's have that discussion if we're talking about money and funding education. The last issue I would suggest is the two times. Does it make sense under finite resources to pay for the third attendance year? So those are just kind of my suggestions. It's certainly up to the committee, but I think if we have less money in the formula, we've got to make the formula more effective to get to that. And the summer school issue that I brought up that currently, because I think largely because of the chilling effect that we've had about eliminating summer school, actually in the formula there is a 25% premium. I support summer school. I don't know that I necessarily support the 25% premium. So those are the kind of four issues that I think we bring. One of the things that this committee asked to reboot is, in our limited budget situation, should we not maybe look at some of these issues in the formula, see whether they are necessities or luxuries we can't afford? That's what I was saying on, yes. I mentioned just broadly, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, was the On the issue of consolidation, and I'll give you a copy of this, the issue of consolidation, the issue of that they're paid for, they're not paid on a per pupil basis in rural districts of 350, that there's a special set amount of money. So they could have one student or 350, that issue. Second issue, more than two times. Third issue, they can be paid for the second preceding year. And lastly would be the 25% premium on summer school attendance.
Okay.
So I'm not offended, but I think we ought to probably come to the body and say, look, here's, you know, right now, just for those of you who are new to the Senate, I mean, the we've never really looked at the formula in totality. Probably there's some members who don't know that those provisions are in there, even those who've been served. And we sort of, somebody doesn't like one component of the formula and they say, well, let's do away with summer school. Or it's sort of a, you know, taking a Chinese dinner and throwing it up against the wall and seeing what sticks. I mean, that's kind of how the legislature has dealt with the formula since it was passed in 2005. And I think tough budget, comprehensive approach.
Yep. We need to wrap up here in just a few minutes. Senator Brown, you've been here the whole time. Any comments or any thoughts you want to... Great. Thank you for sitting in. I think this is a healthy process, and again, like we talked about, this is the first of seven committees, and I think our main task is to listen to what the citizens of the state of Missouri feel about education, and we had approximately 95 emails, and we somewhat summarized those today. What I'd like to do, and I know that Michael and Patrick took very good notes, what I'd like to ask my colleagues on this committee is before we leave Jeff City on Thursday, if you have, and Senator Callahan, you've got something in writing. Senator Cunningham, you gave us an oral thought. If you could give us your ideas on what do you think the priorities are, I would like for you to focus on some of the main ideas that our constituents brought up as kind of a starting point, and then focus on that, and then other areas that are near and dear to us, and then bring that up, because these are some tremendous ideas that the rest of our colleagues need to be aware of. And my thought is then we will, over the weekend, work on a kind of a report, and then I will circulate it among this committee so that you all feel comfortable with that, and then we will present that to our colleagues on Wednesday. Does that timetable sound workable with you all? You can give it to me or to Patrick or to Michael Ruff. And then those in the audience, if you want to chime in and let us know some of your thoughts or concerns based on today's hearing, feel free to give that to us. We'll be drafting that this week and working on over the weekend to present that to the rest of the group. I want to thank everyone for being here today.